Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Stephanie McMillan. Her comics and writing have appeared in hundreds of publications and venues. She's the author of 7 books, including Capitalism Must Die, A Basic Overview of Capitalism and Revolution, and creator of the new calendar 365 Daily Affirmations for Revolutionary Proletarian Militants. Stephanie's been an organizer against capitalism all of her life. So first, of course, thank you for your work, and then second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Derek. It's my pleasure.
So we're airing this on May 1st. What is the significance of that day to you?
Well, May 1st is May Day, which is International Workers' Day. That's a day for the working class to reclaim its struggle and to assert its interests to the maximum extent possible, depending on particular local circumstances. Like in some places in the world, there could be marches of thousands to tens of thousands of people. Other places, there may be smaller events, everything from barbecues to public discussions. In Fort Lauderdale, where I live, we're showing a film called The Hand That Feeds, which is about workers at a hot and crusty bakery in New York, who many of whom were undocumented and all of whom were being paid below minimum wage and forced to work on unsafe equipment. And they complained to the manager, who told them, I don't have to listen to you unless you're a union. So they formed their own independent union, fought back, and against all the odds, won some pretty big concessions. So we wanted to show the film and then invite workers and others from around the area to discuss it, take that their experience as inspiration, and figure out how we can build some struggle here in workplaces where people could back each other up when they're having a problem with abuse or exploitation on a job.
So that sounds all really important. Do you want to talk a little bit about the historical background of May Day?
Sure. Yeah, it emerged from a struggle for the 8-hour workday among workers in the U.S. in the late 1880s. There was a very vibrant and militant and intense labor movement at the time, which it hadn't been structurally legalized yet. So there were no procedures for how workers should fight. So they fought very militantly for their rights, and including through mass strikes. On May 1st, 1886, there was a strike that was across the whole country involving about 300,000 to 500,000 workers. Which, if you imagine that today, it would be, very different from the actual situation we have. So you can imagine, how developed the labor movement was at the time and how far we've gone backwards. But at the time, 30 or 4,000 of those workers were striking in Chicago, and they gathered in Haymarket Square several days later. There was a bomb thrown into a line of cops that killed several of them. That could have been, they didn't know who did it. A lot of people think it was a provocateur. But rather than launch a proper investigation, the authorities used that incident as an excuse to crack down on the labor movement, including executing 4 of the organizers of that demonstration. And since then, that day has been marked throughout the world, not just as a labor holiday where people should be taking the day off work, but actually as a day for workers to demonstrate their collective power.
So before we talk about this in the United States, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about some of the May Day actions or celebrations, either way, around the world over the last 40 years, 30 years?
Well, the range is just incredible. You have, like I was saying, you have thousands of people in some places. You have, I heard of one guy in Kansas who by himself decorates his porch with red flags that he steals from golf courses. So, it's a creative time for workers to assert their power and their the possibility for them to struggle, depending on how strong the movement is, wherever it is. It could be a very militant march. It could be a strike. It could be a very small event. But there's been a range of all of those.
So let's talk about whether May Day is still relevant. Many people talk about how the working class in the United States has shrunk and been weakened to the point of being incapacitated. And there's also the whole question of what has happened to unions, the contrast between 1886 and now with big unions. So is May Day still even relevant?
Yeah, many people say that, the working class is disappearing because things are going to be produced now by 3D printers or something. But somebody still has to run those and somebody still has to make those. And it's not robots now. So we do have a working class of millions of people in the United States still, in spite of a lot of the manufacturing jobs having been offshored. There is still a lot of manufacturing done here. It hasn't actually shrunk. It's only shrunk relevant to the overall population growth, but it hasn't actually gotten smaller. And in the world overall, the labor force, the working class is larger than it's ever been in history before. And as for being relevant, the situation of workers has become so desperate. I do a lot of leafleting and talking to people, and everywhere we go, people are talking about having to have two jobs just to make ends meet. They're suffering from abuse at work, scheduling that is just at the whim of the employer. People talk about having gotten to the end of their rope basically and don't even know how to go forward from here because they're already working to their maximum capacity, and living expenses have gotten so high that they're wondering how they can survive, how they can feed their kids. And it shows just how disposable workers have become also. That conviction that just happened of the Massey Mine CEO who got 1 year in jail for killing 29 workers. That's just an outrage that it's heartbreaking and completely unacceptable. These aren't accidents. They call them accidents, but workplace accidents are not accidents. They're basically murder by capitalists of workers because they can always be prevented. It happens almost always because of cost cutting. They're unwilling to give up even a few pennies of profit to protect the lives of the people who are making all their profits for them. There are actually 150 people every single day who are either killed on the job or die from work-related occupational diseases. And I consider those people murdered by capitalists. And I think that we need to look at it that way. So I definitely think that it's relevant.
Is that 150 people in the US or worldwide?
In the U.S. alone, North Dakota and Texas are some of the are two of the most dangerous places to work because of the natural gas industry. But it happens everywhere. As we can see with these 29 people who died in that mine, if that would happen, if the police killed 150 people every day, if terrorists killed 150 people every day, I mean, that would be a huge social question, but we're taught to not even look at that as murder or killing people. We're taught to see it as something that's sort of ordinary, like it just happens naturally because of unsafe conditions that are there for no particular reason, or that's just how it works. But those unsafe conditions are calculated by the capitalists to make themselves richer. So to me, that's basically killing people for money.
Well, a couple of things. One of them is that I lived in North Idaho for a while, and there was a pretty famous case up there that the bag house or pollution control device on a smelter burned, and the company faced a choice. They could either continue to smelt and send the lead-laden smoke into the community, or they could shut down the place while they fixed the bag house. And it's the reason this is so interesting to me is because there's actual notes. I've seen the handwritten notes from their board meeting when they were choosing to. They figured it was cheaper to go ahead and pay, quote, $5,000 per kid, end quote. Rather than to do the baghouse. So it was a straightforward economic calculation as to what they should do. And of course, nothing ever happened to the people who made that decision.
Yeah, the same thing happened in that mine where they didn't even stop to, you know, pick up the bodies. They just kept the production going. That's what they always do. It's always cheaper to just throw people in the garbage and pretend like we're just objects and things than it is to give up, you know, the profit that we would be making or that would be continued to be made in spite of us, you know, lying on the sidelines. It's pretty disgusting.
The second thing I wanted to mention is a couple of jokes I used to tell, which aren't very funny at all. And there's two riddles. The first question is, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is two life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. And the other one is, what do you get when you cross two nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and at least 10,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full pan benefits. And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, Bhopal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same
mm-hmm.
with Blankenship. It's the same. It's the same with I thought that the guy at BP, Tony Hayward. I thought that he should have been tried for murder too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And instead, you know, he gets to have his life back as he wanted and go, you know, disappear without having any punishment at all. And even when we consider not just the loss of life, but the suffering that happens at the loss of jobs, you know, people who cut jobs get promotions and bonuses that even exceed the amount of wages they would have paid at those jobs in the first place. Like, cutting people's jobs is considered to be good for business.
Well, which leads us to the question of, you know, when you and I have talked about these questions before, when I ask the question, is Mayday still relevant? One of the things you do talk about, too, is offshoring. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, offshoring. And also, I think there's a lot of changes that have happened in the economy and the global economy in the past few decades. The globalization of production, which has led to the offshoring of jobs, paying, you know, a race to the bottom of wages where companies will move their factories from one place to another at the drop of a hat just to save like a penny per product. And I've actually known people who worked with factories that saw that happen, like moving from Bangladesh to Malaysia because a shirt was a penny less from Malaysia. So there's that, and the globalization of the working class. I think we need to look at ourselves as a global class and start figuring out how to coordinate our struggles, because we're fighting against the same companies, the same capitalists across the world. And then there's also structural crisis.
Wait, just to be clear, so you're saying that in part because they are organized globally, that we should be organized globally too?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I just wanted to be clear.
The capitalists are highly organized and on a world scale internationally, and we have to be even more organized, even better organized than they are if we're going to actually challenge their power over us and not to mention win. So the other thing I wanted to mention was the structural crisis that capitalism has gotten itself in. Because even though industrial production is still a large part of their economy and their whole economy is dependent on it, the financialization of the economy has increased to the point where it's become very unstable because there's a lot of fictitious value that's in the economy now floating around, like inflated bubbles. You know, so those constant bubbles forming and bursting have created a lot of chaos and crisis, and there aren't really ways out of it. Everything that the capitalists do to try to fix it, from lowering interest rates to, you know, whatever, they keep making it worse. So I think that we're at a point where, you know, capitalism is in deep crisis. People are suffering a lot, and we really need to start well, it's long past time to start, but we all need to get really serious about how are we going to move forward in this situation, or it's just going to keep getting worse, not for the capitalists, but for us, all of us who are suffering from capitalism.
So before we go on there, there's a couple terms I'd like you to define. You said I don't quite understand them, and readers might not either. One, you said financialization. I don't know what that means. And the other one is, what do you mean by fictitious value? I don't understand either of those terms.
Okay. Before I define those, I'm going to define surplus value, which is the new value that's produced in an economy that is embodied in commodities. And the reason that that's important is because it's the foundation of the entire economy. And the way that capitalists get it is through exploiting labor power. So when a worker goes into a factory and they're paid, $10 an hour or whatever it is, then they produce what is worth perhaps $100 per hour. So that extra $90 is appropriated by the capitalist, and that's what they use as that's a form of profit that they use to reinvest to keep capital growing.
Wait. So just let's be really slow on this. So there's I work somewhere and I'm making jars. And I get paid $10 an hour, and in an hour I make jars that then sell for $100. Is this what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay, and so the $90 that the capitalist gets is what is called surplus value. Is that all right?
That's right. Minus some of it is for
cost of materials,
costs, like
blah blah blah.
Yeah, the building rent, the electricity, and things like that. But the majority of it is just pure profit, and that form of profit is surplus value, and we call it that because it's value that's been stolen from the worker. They produce something that they don't get to keep.
Okay. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So then there's this whole layer of the economy that has kind of been conjured up out of that. Like, if you look at the housing bubble, workers had to make those houses, and those houses had a certain value based on the labor power that they used to make it with. But through speculation and all the gambling that goes on in the economy, the actual prices went a lot higher than their value. So all that extra stuff in the economy, extra value that's shown, numerically, is actually not real embodied value in objects and commodities. So that's what creates this instability, because as soon as investors or speculators realize that everybody else knows that this value isn't really there, they all start dumping it and selling it, and then prices crash, and then that slows production down. And we saw that just recently also with natural gas production, where, the price, everybody invests in it, the price goes too high, and then they dump it, and then the price goes too low, and it causes all kinds of havoc economically. And a lot of times it results by workers getting fired, workers getting thrown out of the economy, large part of the economy not even based on them producing stuff. So it's always on the backs of the people, not really the investors don't really the large investors don't really suffer. It's the smaller ones and everybody else.
So I'm sorry, if you defined financialization in there, I missed it. Or was that whole thing financialization? I'm sorry that I'm being so dense on this. I just want to be really clear. I think what you're saying is really good. I'm just trying to make sure that we have the entire, it's like we have a good foundation for the rest of the pyramid, as it were.
It just means basically, essentially, that the economy is based on finance capital, not industrial capital.
So industrial capital would be like U.S. steel, right?
Right.
So U.S. steel
yeah.
is going to build steel beams, and we understand now that the workers get paid $10 an hour for $100 worth of steel, just to use the same numbers. And now financialization would be somehow Chase Bank comes in, or what is the financialization? How's that work?
Well, that company on the stock market, people start. There's what happens under capitalism is that the actual capital gets concentrated into fewer and fewer hands as companies buy each other up. They become they create monopolies in different sectors of the economy. So you have like one company producing 250 types of beer or whatever. And as capital becomes so concentrated, there becomes too much cash in the economy, and they have to put it someplace. So they basically pour it into speculation. So speculation is really what is inflating, and the overabundance of cash related to actual productive capacity is what creates these bubbles.
And then where does this tie into fictitious value? Which is the fictitious value is the $100 for the steel instead of 10? Is that the fictitious value?
No, that's real value that's been produced by the worker that's stolen by the capitalist. What's fictitious is when the company then trades for, let's say, $1,000 per $100 of value.
Okay.
You have the company that's worth a certain amount that the workers have produced, and then they put it on the stock market and people bid it up 100 times more than that.
And we've all heard about when people are, there's all these various hedge funds and various companies that basically just, bid up all those values. And then how does all of this come together to, as you've said, and this is true, crush the working class and throw whole sections of the masses out of the economy? How does the financialization and all these bubbles, how do they actually affect living, breathing human beings, whether they're in Bangladesh or in West Virginia?
Well, it means that we're not really necessary to them as much as we were. They don't need us as customers so much, and they don't need us as producers so much. It's making the economy kind of immaterial. So it's a bunch of numbers floating around.
Okay, I'm sorry to do this. I hear you, but a bunch of numbers floating around, you can't eat them. I mean, ultimately the economy has to come back down to bread or bacon or even a jar. I mean, a physical thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. And that's why part of the crisis is that's the root of the crisis, is that, yes, they need that industry, and that industry needs to be valued in a real way. But there's so much that of the economy that's not that it's not actually real. But yeah, we need to live on real things. All that fictitious value, that's why it's called fictitious. It doesn't exist. It's fake. But that's what our economic health supposedly is based on. When they say the economy is doing well, that's what they're talking about. And that's why also a lot of people are calling for reshoring. You know, they call it reshoring jobs, bringing manufacturing back, because they do know that that is the basis of a healthy economy. So that's what's behind those calls.
But how does that work when I'm manufacturing jars and I can get people to make jars in Malaysia for 2 cents a piece and it costs me $1 a piece to make them in the U.S.? And as a capitalist, why would I do that? And
you wouldn't, and that's why they don't.
And so how do we maybe this is anticipating a question later, but how do we force them to do that? How does that – well, let's just back off for a second, and we'll go to sort of the next scheduled question, and we'll come around.
Well, actually, I kind of like that question.
Okay, great.
I mean, how do we force them to do that? How do we force them to do anything? It is, we need to fight for it. And that's why we need to have a global working class movement. When you have workers in one part of the world who are getting 2 cents as opposed to, you know, our $10, how do we actually force a global minimum wage so that companies can't do that? They can't chase wages lower and lower around the world and creating more and more misery and actually forcing us to compete against each other to be the lowest paid worker. I mean, that's the position that we're in right now, is where you know, we're basically competing for scarce jobs against other workers, causing all kinds of conflict and antagonism among ourselves, instead of uniting and figuring out how are we going to raise the bar for the lowest paid workers so that all of us can unite against our actual class enemy, the capitalists.
Well, this reminds me of the book How the Irish Became White, which is a discussion of how when the Irish came over to the United States, a lot of them faced very difficult choices because they could, as they themselves were being severely exploited by the capitalists, they were then also, they had choices of they could either act in working class solidarity with the free blacks in the North, or they could sort of join the white class by not having working class solidarity. And I wrote about this in Culture Make Believe and how it's very difficult on an individual level because, yeah, you can talk about working class solidarity all you want, but if you're starving, if your children are dying, you're going to go ahead and take whatever job you can for less. It's very so I guess I'm leading into the question of organizing. I mean, that's, I don't know what I'm leading into. It's just, it's how do you get people to organize when they need food right now?
I know, that's the big problem. That's why we're so weak, is because we've lost that spirit of collectivity, and the ideology of the capitalist, which is individualism, has infected all of us in the world, really, to you know, care first for our own interests instead of sacrificing for the collective whole, which is, you know, the working class has naturally an ideology of collectivity because workers can't produce anything without each other. They all work together on a product and they work together in the factory and they work together. The only way that they can assert their interests is collectively. If we do it individually, all we can do is like trade one bad job for another. I hear so many times people saying, oh, I'm at the end of my rope, I'm going to quit my job. But then what? You have to get another one that's equally as bad. So, or, you know, we just suck it up or just, you know, try to cope on an individual level. That's just weakening ourselves and making everything worse for ourselves. So, the only way forward is through class solidarity, and that's an ideology, a mindset, an attitude that we really need to bring back, and we need to be out there insisting upon it, you know, stepping out for others when they're exploited and abused. You know, we need to be, there are some people still out there who believe this way, and so we need to gather ourselves together and become a social force where we can go out there and demonstrate the power of collective action. And hopefully, you know, when other people see that who aren't convinced or who are too afraid to step out, you know, when they see that they will be backed up and their kid won't starve because we've got strike funds and mutual support and all these things, then, you know, that can only grow in strength. But we have to have the first people step out first, you know, the ones who are the most determined to show that this can work.
This reminds me of a wonderful line by Kathleen Dean Moore, which is when people ask her, what can one person do? She always says, don't be one person.
Oh, that's excellent. I like that. Yeah. Because that one individually, we're nothing. We're weak. We're victims. We get crushed like a bug. But if, you know, the same action done by 10 people or 100 people, we can win these things. You know, I've seen cases where even as few as three workers writing a letter together and marching it over to the manager has frightened the management so much that, oh, God, the workers are going to organize now, that they've caved in. Or people unionize at one workplace and another place at the same company gives everyone a raise because they're afraid of our organization. I was just actually this morning leafleting in front of a place where I've been there a few times, and they had a paid thug waiting for us to threaten us and force us to leave. So, I mean, every single time that workers assert their power, you can see how afraid capitalists are of that and by how strongly they try to repress it. So that actually proves that our strength is, it might be latent, it might be sleeping, but it is incredibly powerful when we start acting.
Thank you for saying all that. And let's back up a second to that question that we started and then didn't really go to, which is, you know, this radio show focuses on preventing the destruction of the natural world. And you've said many times that capitalism is killing the planet. Why does capitalism kill the planet?
Yeah, that's our biggest problem currently, you know, that humanity's ever faced. And if we don't solve that problem, if we don't get rid of capitalism, then none of this other stuff will even matter. So we really have to understand why capitalism is compelled to keep expanding and keep killing the planet if we're going to, you know, figure out how to stop it. So it has this growth imperative that profit is its only goal, because because it's based on exploitation, which is extracting this surplus value from labor power, from this extra value that it takes from workers, capitalism as a whole can't pay its workforce in one country, let's say, can't pay its workforce enough to buy all the products that they produce, because they're not paid as much as the products are going to be sold for, as much as they're worth. So it has to open up new markets, it has to expand, it has to push this stuff elsewhere, and it has to keep trying to get a cheaper labor force. So, and then not only that, but capitalists have to keep expanding at least as much as their interest payments are. So whatever the interest rate is also determining that. So capital has a motion and a life of its own, and it cannot stop growing, or it's going to not collapse, but have these structural crises where a lot of productive capacity has to be destroyed and then rebuilt and so on. So there's no way for the natural world to be protected under capitalism, because its growth imperative will force, I mean, it has the state also to ensure that it has the power to keep extracting at an ever and increasing rate that isn't just a gradual increase, but is always a certain percentage over what has been expanded before. So it's like a rate that, you know, it just goes crazy. It's not like under feudalism where they might expand slowly because as they deplete land, but it's a much faster rate of expansion that it's required to do. So they're willing to do anything to destroy the entire planet, to kill everyone. And you may think it's irrational, but capital doesn't have emotions. It doesn't have any kind of ethics except to concentrate itself and accumulate. And even capitalists themselves are basically stewards of capital. They act according to its needs. And you could have a nice person who really wants to save the planet be a capitalist, and then they will have to act according to it. And they can't change its nature. They can't stop the process, even if they wanted to.
You know, this is one of the things that from even before I was particularly politicized, this is just something that's really struck me, is the whole question of who's in charge and mm-hmm. how, you know, Lewis Mumford talked about this with authoritarian technics, where you have a social system is actually running the whole show. Excuse me, and how we can it's just stunning to me that we hear this all the time, that, you know, oh, this is the needs of capital. Or there's a great line by this Brazilian general when Brazil was a military dictatorship. Somebody asked him how the economy was doing, and he said, the economy is doing very well, the people not so well. And mm-hmm. that's exactly what we're talking about with all this, and it's just crazy. It's, you know, I've done all my books, you've done all your books, and, you know, it still just strikes me as completely nuts that we have a social system that is not actually alive, or, I mean, you can talk about it as being alive, or, but it's not a real thing. It's just a social system, but it's not. But the real living beings are being harmed by this non-living social system. That's just nuts.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, and we need to understand it and how it works if we're going to actually try to destroy it, because it does need to be destroyed. It can't be just reformed or stopped. And we have to understand who can destroy it. Like, a lot of us can understand it, and we can talk against it, but and we can declare ourselves against it, be anti-capitalist, but that's not enough. What actually has to happen is the only class that can actually end capitalism is the working class, because they face it in an antagonistic relationship every single day of their lives, where their energy, time, labor power is being stolen. And if it's, and the, they do it by paying these, you know, by paying wages, by with through the wage system, and paying less than the value of what they produce. So if, I mean, the workers are wage slaves, and if they emancipate themselves from wage slavery, that destroys capital. So the working class collectively as a whole, emancipating itself from wage slavery, from exploitation, and the production of surplus value that gets taken from by capitalists, is the only way that capital can be destroyed as the material that it is, and also as a system. And it's the only way that a pathway, a possibility of anything else can, an alternative system can even be conceived of. People have a lot of different ideas about a new kind of system that they can sort of like change this one into, or reform it into, or, you know, just make some tweaks or whatever, but that can never happen. The only thing that can bring a new system, a new alternative into being, is if the workers take control over production and over the entire political system, because the political system is what allows you to control production also. So there's, you know, that's a big task, but it's what we have to do if we're actually going to stop capitalism from destroying the world.
You've talked about destroying all of capitalism's structures of reproduction at economic, political, ideological spheres. Can you talk about that a little bit more? I don't really understand what that means. What are historical structures of reproduction?
Capital is not just a number, it's not just the quantity of wealth, it's an ensemble of social relations that we live under that include the economic relationship, the antagonistic relationship between labor and capital itself that happens in the sphere of production, the economic sphere, and then it has the political sphere, which is power over how things are produced in society.
Okay, wait. Let's mm-hmm. back up a second. I am a capitalist, and I own the jar making company. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so, let's put all of these structures of reproduction of in these spheres. Let's put all of them. I work best when I get examples that I can see. So
okay.
I'm the capitalist who owns this jar making company, and so mm-hmm. now talk about these spheres in terms of that to help me understand.
Okay. Well, you own this jar making factory. The law, which is the political sphere, allows you, it tells you that you have the right to own this factory as an individual, which is an ideological, you need a belief that private property to make that law legitimate. So your economic control is over what is produced at the factory. You're going to make jars, you're going to pay people this much, you're going to sell the jars for that much, you're going to run the factory on 3 shifts, you're going to force people to work overtime. All these things are your decisions at the economic level. And then at the political level, you've got the law on your side that you own this thing. The police will protect your ownership of that thing if anybody challenges it.
And if the workers go on strike, then the police will generally come on my side.
Yes. Or you might even be lucky enough to be in a right-to-work state, and, you know, you can just fire them all if you want to. And, the regulations are broken down, so you can put your toxic crap in the river and save money that way. So the whole political system, the law, the enforcement and all that stuff is on your side. And then ideologically, the whole culture has been conditioning us to believe that this is all okay, that you have the right to private property, that you have the right to control what's produced, that you have the right to decide for people how much they're going to be paid. All these things are considered natural under capitalism, and we've been conditioned to just accept it like it's normal and natural and fine. And that's the ideology, and that's been inculcating us through school, through church, you know, every institution that teaches us anything, the nuclear family. We learn that these relationships are normal and to be accepted. So on all of these levels, we need to have class struggle. The capitalists rule in every sphere. So, and it's not just economic sphere, it's all of them. So we have to wage struggle in all of those spheres to show how this is not acceptable, it's not enforceable, and it's not going to be tolerated.
And so how do we do that?
The only way is by organizing ourselves. The capitalists put a lot of effort into disorganizing the working class, disuniting it, creating divisions between people. I mean, you mentioned racism before, that sexism, nationalism, all these different things that are supposed to divide us is really to preserve the capitalist's ability to stay in power and not have us have any kind of different system. So we need to overcome all those things through the struggle against capital as workers. You know, we start on the job in small ways, training ourselves to fight collectively. It may seem very small and inadequate at this moment, but we have to start from where we are. We can't just conjure a movement out of nothing. We have to start from basic unity building, you know, in the workplace and asserting our rights, learning how to speak up when we're being violated, learning how to speak up for each other and stand with each other against the boss, learning how to not identify with management, you know, to see them as an enemy, the enemy that they really are.
You know, one of the things that's really striking me as we're having this conversation is that so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And it's sounding to me like, as well as organizing, well, I mean, this is the first step, really. It sounds to me like you're saying something very similar, that the first thing we have to do is drive individualism and capitalism out of ourselves, not as an individual. That act is not – that doesn't do anything to capitalism itself, but that's a really important thing, to see them as the enemy so that then you can start to organize properly.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think ideology, individualism, opportunism – you know, that me first mentality, or I have to save myself. Those are the kind of things we have to overcome before we can even begin to stand up for each other.
So we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I have two main questions. One of them is, how do listeners become involved? But before that, are there other topics you want to talk about for, like, a couple minutes to hit them really quickly that I haven't asked you the appropriate questions for?
No, I think your questions have been really great. I think our discussion has been pretty wide-ranging. I do encourage people to begin organizing wherever they are, especially in the workplace. But if they aren't workers, then there are still, you know, there are a lot of things that can be done. Supporting worker struggles, also exposing the nature of capitalism, talking to each other. I mean, the first step in organizing, people always ask, is like, what do I do? But the very first step is finding somebody who is like-minded. So going out there, talking to people, it starts with one conversation and building unity. It's a long and tedious process. And I want to encourage people not to get daunted by that or discouraged by how long it takes and how hard it is, because it really is our only option and there aren't any shortcuts to this.
So
in terms of how
be really tangible for me. So in my fictitious jar factory, there is a person who is listening to the show who is a who works at the jar factory, who is not happy with the fact that, I mean, I don't know why they're not happy. I'm the job creator, you know? Anyway, besides which, I contribute to lefty causes, so what's the big deal? Anyway, so there's a worker there, or there's a person, a human being there who works at it. So how do they start this process if they're just, I mean, they're working on my assembly line for jars. What do they do? How do they start?
On their lunch break, talk about how, you know, why are we forced to work overtime when we're not being paid time and a half and we're only being paid X amount? Or why, you know, the boss yelled at somebody, it wasn't fair. They didn't do anything wrong, so we should say something about that. I mean, it starts that small and that granular. But you also asked how people could get involved, and I have two or three different suggestions. In terms of if you're having issues at work and you want to organize in the workplace, there are many organizations that do that, or you can form your own, but we also have one called Worker Struggle that we're starting to build in Fort Lauderdale and other places, and you can look us up at workerstruggle.org. We also have a rapid response network for people who are interested in being contacted when violations happen on the job and they need outside support. And that actually has resulted in several grievances being addressed when people have done mass emailings or phone calls to a company or embarrassed them in some way. That actually has been pretty effective. So that's another way to get involved. And either way, I would like to invite people to email me, and I can hook you up with either of those options. And my email address is Steph, STEPH, @minimumsecurity.net.
Well, thank you. Is there anything else you want to say to people before we sign off?
Let's all struggle for a May Day that is vibrant, determined, and militant. Happy May Day.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Stephanie McMillan. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.